The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
But first, the HSE has been front and centre of the news for many months now, its employees hailed as the vital frontline staff that saw our country through the first wave of the global pandemic. However, its CEO, Paul Reid, now faces the unenviable task of leading the health services into the challenges of the winter months and a possible second wave of the virus. We caught up with Paul Reid yesterday, and I began by asking him about the tragic case of Ruth Morrissey, who died last Sunday, aged 39. She was among hundreds of women affected by the controversy around incorrect smear test results. I first put it to Paul Reid that he was sharply criticised by her solicitor for raising the question of an apology to her family at a press conference on the day of her funeral. Her solicitor felt it was very inappropriate and said it beggared belief that he would do that. Did he feel his timing was wrong?
Well, look, it's obviously a very sensitive issue, this, and the reality was that we were doing a media briefing on that morning. I certainly felt it would have been insensitive of me not to make some reference to the funeral taking place. And also, as I had corresponded to Paul Morrissey through this solicitor, I thought appropriate that I should reference that. Ruth's a very courageous woman. That's what I wanted to acknowledge. And I did want to acknowledge that we had sent an apology across. The timing of these issues are, you know, very difficult to call, and certainly my intention was to not cause any more hurt to Ruth's family, Paul, Libby, the daughter. But it's always a difficult judgment call. I certainly didn't want to be, you know, I wanted to address it up front in my delivery rather than reacting to questions on it. And that's how I set about doing it.
The Irish Independent says that the letter of apology only went out that morning, which I suppose raises the question that has been raised before about HSE delayed apologies in relation to what are often really tragic cases.
Yeah, look,
why are they so late?
Yeah, well, look, sometimes the legal system has to take its process, and this is a process that was being led by the State Claims Agency. Certainly, I do want to say, as CEO to HSE, I do want us to take on those issues stronger and better. And certainly, in my first year, it's something that I've tried to do. We did have to manage some issues around cervical check in the first few weeks of my term. I did front it up, straight up, that we acknowledged we'd made mistakes. We'd acknowledged there were further issues that we had to address, and we set out about addressing them. So I do want a CEO to be, HSE, to be a bit more upfront about acknowledging the issues that we have. But you will appreciate there's legal processes as well. It doesn't make it always as easy as we'd like on a personal level.
Do you think there may be legal processes pending in the future around the fact that a number of HSE employees and staff have died because of coronavirus, and that there were over 8,000 confirmed cases among healthcare workers?
Well, right at the start of this pandemic, global pandemic, as we saw what was happening across the world, there's no doubt that as Ireland looked on, as the health service looked on, we were quite scared by what was happening. And one of our primary and key concerns is obviously to protect our frontline staff. And that was our primary driver, to secure personal protective equipment and protect our staff. Sadly, as you know, we have lost a total of 8 healthcare workers all across the healthcare system. And that's always really sad. And one of the most difficult things I've had to do is talk to some of those families after. And it's a very difficult process. So our primary aim is always to do that. Just in terms of what might happen next or whatever, you know, I will always want to ensure we do the right thing. The infection rates amongst healthcare workers has been high.
The nursing organisation says the highest in the world.
No, that's not factually true. The reality of some of the figures, it's not true. I mean, the reality, if you just by simple comparison, first of all, some countries aren't even testing. So, you know, it's not always a direct comparison.
On the question of PPE for staff, you mentioned there that the HSE was doing its best to procure PPE as early as possible. When you reflect back on what have been very, very high numbers, what do you think you could have done differently?
Well, just to give you a scale of what was happening, we would normally spend about less than 20 million per year on PPE. Our total spend this year will be close to 1 billion euros, if not just over it. And that's the scale of the volume that we've had to secure. And the second point to say is this was a global search a global pandemic, and every country in the world was seeking to secure this PPE. And one of the strongest manufacturing countries, China, had shut down. We were securing PPE, and some other major countries were coming in and outbidding us from 3, 4, 5 times. But thankfully, with the reach Ireland has between our ambassadors, between the IDA Ireland, the Department of Foreign Affairs, we secured significant volumes above and beyond even countries like the UK by any comparison. So it was really a global search. It was a global war and battle to get this PPE.
When you look at more recent weeks and how the figures have gone for confirmed cases, and the country by and large has done very well in getting the virus under control, but in recent weeks many people have been concerned and focused about foreign travel and visitors coming into Ireland bringing in new cases. But an analysis of the figures suggests that I think it's around 48% of new cases in recent weeks have been within the health service and healthcare workers. And it has been attributed to some of it to the fact that some people had symptoms but didn't want to lose out on overtime or wages or money that they need basically to earn a living. So they covered up and they still showed up for work. Does that say something about the overall terms and conditions for healthcare workers?
No, I think you need to kind of unpick a lot of that. It primarily transmit within the communities. So there certainly are a percentage that have transmitted from travel, but the highest penetration transmit from communities. So people not contracting it specifically in the health system, but transmitting it in the community, and then it can ultimately transmit to co-workers, etc. So there's a few issues around that.
So do you think there hasn't really been a case of people having symptoms but still going to work because they need the money? Certainly trade unions have been very vocal about this.
Oh yeah, I mean, what we would always, our occupational health teams are at the front line as well, and they would give strong advice to people. And our strong advice absolutely is, if people have symptoms, they obviously need to be referred and they need to be tested, and they also need to isolate if tested positive. We had very significant numbers of staff, a very high percentage of staff out isolating throughout this period. So that was a challenge in itself for us.
Having lots of staff out isolating because they need to be tested or they have symptoms and there's a query as to whether they have the virus or not. Presumably that leads to hiring more short-term agency staff who are not direct employees of the HSE but through recruitment firms, and they have very different terms of employment. Is that an issue?
Well, if you look what we did so far during this phase, we've recruited, we've about 4,000 staff extra now on our books than we had at the start of this phase. It is our intention to continue to secure those people that we've secured right now. And if we've secured any nurses or doctors, I want to keep them on our books. I want to recruit more consultants. And we will do that as part of our plans for the next phase.
You became chief executive of the HSE last year, so you had a period of time to settle into the job, but still not a huge amount of time until this pandemic hit. Nobody could have seen it coming. I'm sure there are lots of people who are chief executives of companies and corporations and agencies and prime ministers of countries who perhaps wish they hadn't found themselves in that role when this happened. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm just over a year in the HSE, and it kind of feels like a year of two different halves. So for the first year, I was trying to consolidate what we were doing, particularly around our financial performance. And certainly my first phase, what I found that the HSE was a bit at war with all of our key stakeholders. We were at war with government. We were at war with the department. We were at war with the minister. We were at war with trade unions. And I wanted to stabilise those relationships. And
were you losing that war?
I think if we had continued the way we were, I mean, it's one issue having a war with some of your stakeholders some of the time, but all of them all the time. And I don't mean that as a criticism of anybody. It's just the environment we were in. And so certainly for the first 6 months, I was working strongly. And I think if you look at that phase, we had built up some trust from government. We had secured a financial position and a much stronger basis towards the year end of last year.
There was a huge amount of money spent, and a huge amount of that was necessary. You know, you mentioned about spending €1 billion this year on PPE instead of, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 or 30 million in a normal year. But there was other money that people can question. So, for example, the contract with taking over the private hospitals, which ended up being underutilised, a lot of tens of millions spent on booking out hotels that might be needed in emergency situations that were never used. There's a lot of money went down the drain.
Yeah, and look, that's a very fair kind of challenge that we will be open to scrutiny on. But I just take you back and just picture what we were all seeing across Europe. Picture the scenes that we were seeing in Italy, in Lombardy, and we saw a very frantic hospital system. Now, we know that our hospital system here in Ireland, on a good day, works at 95% capacity. If we had had any of the potential surge that Italy had seen, and this is not China now, this is very close to us, so we had to immediately build capacity to take on that issue. Now, certainly, if I look forward for the next phase, would I do some of that differently? Most certainly. And I remember standing up in front of the...
What would you do differently? Use the private hospitals in a different way?
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, we are now looking at planning if, A, there's another surge, hopefully there isn't. B, if there's kind of regional or local kind of major surges. Or C, if there's peaks and troughs of this virus. And we would see a potential solution. We are in discussions with the private hospital groups that would look at a more agile kind of dial, where you could dial up some flexibility and dial it down. How you'd protect against a surge if it did happen, particularly in the winter season.
How well equipped are you for a second surge, should that come?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a kind of reflection of our learnings from the first phase. And I think we're in a stronger position on many fronts. Knowledge of PPE, much better. Stocks now, but also we've built up indigenous Irish industry to give us a bit of resilience, much better.
Looking back on your career, going back to the start, you worked in telecommunications. That was your first job. What were you doing there?
Yeah, I started, as I said before, people often say they started on the ground, at ground level. Well, I started on the ground level. I was an underground cable jointer. I started as a trainee installer working underground networks. Progressed through Aircom over a 28-year career period, and literally came from the shop floor. I was a trade union official for a few years as well, and went through management roles, various different roles in the organisation over many years, and ultimately became the executive director of their networks and technology.
One of the things you had to do in the management role in Aircom was reduce staff numbers from about 16,000 to 5,000. It's a hell of a career journey to go from trade union into culling staff numbers by thousands, isn't it?
Moving into a management role, yes, you can always be accused of the poacher turned gamekeeper. But the reality for me was I had really good relationships with trade unions, and that has supported me. It never makes it easy, but it has supported me as I went into a role in Deeper and was negotiating with 26 trade unions and Fingal, and indeed now with the HSE. And it is about relationships, you know. You do debate the issues and you do try seek win-win issues, our solutions. But for me, it was a great experience.
When you go back to growing up, you're originally from Finglas, quite a large family of six, was it?
Mm-hmm. All
of you?
Yeah.
And your mom was instrumental in really in bringing up all of you.
Yeah, we grew up in Finglas. I still live in Finglas, although I spent a lot of my time in Leitrim as well. But we grew up in a very working class area, very socially deprived area. And yes, my mother would have pretty much raised six of us for a lot of the time anyway, certainly.
Yeah, was she on her own in doing that?
Yeah, my dad, you know, these things happen in families, and he wasn't there for a significant period of our time. Thankfully, and something I'm pleased about, later on everybody did reconcile, and my dad did play a great role in supporting a lot of his grandchildren. I think that was nice for everybody. But yeah, certainly my mother was to the fore, working very hard herself in two or three jobs a day, cleaning services, and so it was, you know, she reared us well. All of her family have done quite well for ourselves in terms of raising our own families. But a difficult period. And
how did that influence you later on, do you think, Paul?
I think it grounds you. From my perspective, I never lose perspective. You know, I got a second chance at education, left school at 16 without a leaving cert. But I did get a second chance to do a degree and a master's. But I've always remained grounded, and I, you know, I think it always keeps you with a good social conscience, because from my perspective, I've seen many of my earlier friends go the wrong road, and maybe get involved in drugs, mental health abuse, or mental health issues, and alcohol abuse, and you know, you do count your blessings.
So when you were growing up, did you have ideas about what it was you wanted to do career-wise? Did you think in terms of getting a job as the first thing and I'll worry about it afterwards? Or what was on your mind?
Yeah, I would have always been very ambitious. I mean, even in school, although I did leave early, I was quite good at school and I enjoyed it. But just the way it was, I left it after inter-cert, as it was called at the time. And most of my class did as well, that's the way it was. And I was never an engineer, I was never a salesperson, but I managed big organisations. So I think that stood with me, you know, that understanding of how organisations work is the way I describe it in a corporate world. You know, you have to really understand what makes an organisation tick, you know.
You seem like quite a driven person. Where do you think that comes from?
That's a really good one. And it's something that has stuck with me, you know, throughout. I'm very competitive. If I play anything, I played a bit of sports, obviously, throughout my career, or throughout my childhood and onwards. And I was always very competitive, probably broken every bone in my body sometimes.
So it wasn't table tennis you were playing then?
No, I was playing soccer and football, but I think I thought I was 6'4", where I'm really only 5'4", going into those tackles. So I think it's just something that's with me. What's driven it? Maybe it's growing up. Maybe it's, you know, we had to strive for everything that we had, and getting to work, all of the family getting to work. You know, there was nothing there handed down, other than a good rearing by my mother.
Now, you said that you like to keep grounded, and you do a bit of tweeting. And I know in one tweet exchange, somebody was slagging you off about your accent, saying you had an inner city accent or something like that. Was that, did that make you bristle?
No, it was a bit of fun, really. It was a reply to some particular tweet, and someone said, "Sure, you know, how can somebody from the inner city Dublin be running the HSE? We're all in trouble," or something like that. I just wittingly commented back that, you know, I'm not from the inner city, I'm from the north side, you know. But a little bit of a point being made, that, you know, it's we should never judge a book by the cover. And anyway, this isn't about accents, or it's not about, you know, presentation, it's about delivery. No matter what we do in life.
In your view, how would you describe morale among healthcare workers right now? On the one hand, everyone acknowledges the sacrifices and the extraordinary job that they have done in recent months. And that must be a boost of a sort to people. On the other hand, there have been 8,000 confirmed cases among healthcare workers of COVID. And that must be a massive blow to morale at the same time.
I think the morale of staff during COVID has improved. I know it's always fragile, but I think it has improved for a couple of reasons. The public recognition of what was happening and what our staff were committing to do, and particularly frontline workers, but all workers.
Will those who have contracted COVID through their work, especially in an environment where they feel that the PPE was inadequate, will they be compensated financially?
Well, look, that's a process which we will always look at in terms of where we're putting in place supports we put in place throughout this whole process in terms of supports for people who have either contracted the virus or equally who have just felt the pressure. And I've met some people and I know some people who have just felt the pressure. So we've had to put some in some mental health supports around all of that.
But what about financial support? Some people may take legal action. Have you received any legal action of the correspondence of that kind?
Personally, I haven't, but those processes could happen in various parts of the system, so I don't say a definite no to that. But look, that's a process which we'd always look at in its own right in terms of legal issues that may or may not arise.
We saw recently the death of Dr. Ali, who had worked in the matter and fought hard against the illness for a long time and sadly passed away. Do you think he was let down by the HSE?
And just again, my condolences, Dr. Ali, and indeed the other healthcare workers who have passed away during this process. The reality of this disease is it's an awful disease. Everybody can get this disease. That's the really public message that I want to put out. And certainly our healthcare workers are more susceptible because they're in very difficult circumstances.
But inevitably, his family, as they grieve, are also going to ask the question of, well, could things have been done differently that he would still be here with us? Could things have been done differently?
And that would be an absolute natural reflection the family would have, and we would have, and we will always have in terms of our healthcare workers. What can we do differently? What can we do better? You know, we're always a learn. I want us to be always a learning organisation. I'm absolutely open as the CEO to evaluate any learnings that we can, that, whether that's from nursing homes, whether that's from healthcare workers, infection rates. Of course, we are wide open.
Well, Paul Reid, Chief Executive of the HSE, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Richard.